Welcome to another episode of the Mindhack Books podcast. We're talking about the sixth book in the Dune series. So this is the final one written by Frank Herbert.
Yeah.
And it was written in 1985 and has 624 pages. And this is the conclusion to our long Dune series of books. Thank you so much, Paolo, for sticking with me.
Not at all.
Very happy you're still here. I want to say that it always feels, I guess I can say, special or somehow just nice to talk about books to me. And it's increasingly difficult the more you get into obscure books and the deeper you get into a series, the more difficult it gets to find a single person to talk to you about it. So I wanted to say thank you. I really appreciate that.
No, same here. I bothered you to read book 5 and 6 for like 3 years.
I always wanted to read it.
I kept pushing you to do it, so you know, so it's good.
Yeah, it's always nice. It always feels like there's something to learn or something to talk about, have a conversation that has meaning. So I really this is the reason we have this podcast, and one of the main reasons, other than the Free Body Problem trilogy, was to talk about Dune. So
yeah,
this is kind of a milestone for me that it has been accomplished. We're talking about the last book.
Yeah.
By Frank Herbert. And to address the elephant in the room straight on is that Frank Herbert died 1 year after this book was released. People have a lot of opinions about the sequels and his son and all this. But I want to say his wife also died 1 year before this book was released. And unfortunately, both passed away because of cancer complications. Beverly Herbert had lung cancer and Frank Herbert had pancreatic cancer, and he died because of complications after surgery.
Yeah.
So it was very sad, and the ending of this book felt very final to me, and there is like an afterword by Frank Herbert talking about all this. Did it make you sad?
Not particularly.
Okay, I meant to just mention it because it felt to me like a like Frank Herbert knew that this was the last one, because...
Yeah, that's what many people say.
I felt like that as well, especially after the last word by Frank Herbert after the book finished. So it was very sad, kind of sweet sad, I would say. It's very heartfelt, very nice what he said about his wife. And until now, I didn't know that she had a big say in the creative decisions and in the storytelling and some of her ideas. I didn't know that she played a big role.
Yeah, I didn't know until I read the sixth book. Reading a little bit about, you know, what the ending could mean and everything like that.
So before we talk about the usual things, how did we like it and all that stuff, I have two things I've been waiting to talk about, and one of them is this.
Okay.
So did it feel to you like Frank Herbert wanted to put everything he has left into the final book and just kind of use everything he's prepared and put it out there, because this might be the last book he writes about Dune?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so, no.
I had a constant feeling of too much going on at the same time and nothing happening at the same time.
Okay.
I'll talk about it more later, but to sum up, I felt like there are so many ideas listed. Like, I've been hit left and right with all this, so to speak, like wisdom and quotes and like all these concepts and ideas and things. And at the same time, the plot's not really moving anywhere. So I almost felt like the writer felt he has to just use his ideas. He's like got like a list of brainstorming stuff and he has to like put it in there because this might be the last time to use it. So just put it all in there.
I mean, it could be. It felt, we talked about this a little bit also in the ending of book 5, like it felt a little bit tired, like at some points, you know, the characters were kind of tired of fighting, tired of everything, tired of playing a certain role in the story. I did get that feeling throughout the book.
Me too.
Yeah, at the end of the fifth book, you know, with the destruction of Arrakis, it felt like he was done and saying like, you know, did people want me to do certain things and want to talk about this and want to live in these memories? And you know what? I'm just going to destroy everything.
Yeah. Which is a good move. I applaud that.
Yeah, no. I agree. If I need to share kind of a very unpopular opinion, I think episode 8 of Star Wars did a very good job in trying to do this. And, you know, one of the most famous lines was Kylo Ren talking about destroying the past.
I really like episode 8, actually. I didn't know you like it as well.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like it
too. That's a surprise to me. I thought you didn't.
No, it's the only one I like of the new ones.
It did everything I wanted, exactly. Like, they destroyed it. And I was like, yes, and now do new stuff, please.
Yeah.
And then they're like, nope.
And they were like, no, fans don't like it. Fans want the same thing over and over.
So Frank didn't hold back. He went forward and he tried to do new things. One of my favorite things about, or maybe the why I still like this book a lot, is the forewords of the chapters. I think they're so much packed in and so condensed, so short. Like, all the, I don't want to keep saying wisdom or philosophy, but just like food for thought, maybe it's a good phrase.
Okay.
There's a lot of food for thought, like in the prefaces of the things, and a lot of them I really liked. I was looking forward to the next chapter to read the preface. And I felt like I was kind of bored with the plot and then hit in the face with some like nice preface. And then I had the same feeling about all these concepts. There was like, Andrade has a mystical sea child, like bam, in your face. Then we're gonna make cyborgs out of you, bam. Futars have handlers, bam. There's a secret weapon you'll never see, bam. It's like, Duncan can see the Matrix, bam. Yeah. There is a bush that literally screams and talks at you or some shit, bam. Would you like to be a horse, bam. It's like, what? It's like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I felt like it's so scattered and none of these things were really explored. They were just like there. Yeah. And all of them were interesting, but none of them were explored.
Well, I think
problem.
The horse part is more as a joke. But yeah, some of the other things, like the weapon part, I remember I was pretty confused. I was like, okay, what are they talking about? Like, is this something they're going to discuss or...
A perfect segue to my second point. So I want to talk about like this being kind of a final, and the second point I really want to talk about was there's something I really like and dislike. I'm not really sure what to think about it, and that's also from the previous book when I complained that when Teg was at the Onat Matre's building, I don't know where it was, some kind of headquarters, and he first met the Onat Matre, and then he was like, oh, I'm gonna slaughter this whole house, and I'm gonna kill all these people. Cut, and it's already done.
Yeah.
And we like fast forward. And this happened so many more times in here, and I don't know if I like it or if I hate it. On one hand, I respect the sentiment that this book is not about fights and exciting action, and it's not important. So we kind of skip it. But this is almost like too much. It's almost like never talked about. And there are so many things like the weapon that just happen. And it's kind of implied they happened, but never really confirmed or said it happened. And I'm almost like at the edge of, it did even happen? Like, what happened? Like, you know? Like, what actually happened?
I think
happened?
You're feeling like One Piece fans. So many times the author is like hinting at these big fights and showing like the beginning of a big fight, and then it just shows the consequences 30 chapters later, and you're like, what? Why? Like, couldn't we see this? Like, what happened here? How did this happen?
I didn't even care about seeing it. I just wanted confirmation, like, what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, for instance, I guess for listeners who are here for the sixth book, I don't really know we should care about spoilers. So I'll say, like, a spoiler that's not even, like, relevant in the book, because I don't even know if it happened. So whatever. So the Bene Telaxu, they just, like, destroyed now.
Yeah, it happened between book and five and six.
And I wasn't sure the whole book, like, where did they say that? Like,
I think it says, like, briefly. At the beginning, when they explain like why Saitel is with them, they destroyed the planet and their whole civilization, so he's kind of like the last Telaxu left.
Yeah, he mentions he's the last. Did the Honored Matres kill them? Did something else kill them?
The Honored Matres destroyed them, because like they were supposed to be allies, and then they actually allied themselves with the Bene Gesserit, so it was kind of punishment.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah, so what do you think about this? Do you like this or do you hate this? I mean, the concept of a lot of build-up and then the confrontation is kind of skipped and then the consequences are explored.
I think this is something that happens pretty often in Dune. If you go back to the very first book, right, there is that big time skip, which is, I think, about 2 years when, you know, Paul has become kind of a leader. He's not the overall leader of the Fremen, but he started leading... like Siege Tapper together with Stilgar, and they do a lot of stuff and they destroy a lot of the Arkonnen's machines and do a lot of things, but
true, yeah,
you only see the consequences of that, you only learn what happened from like other characters' dialogues, and it's just kind of hinted.
Yeah, it happens a bunch, but here it somehow bothered me. I don't know. I just wasn't sure what happened like at some time. Maybe I was just not thinking clearly.
I think I don't know. So in this one, I think in particular in the sixth book, what it suffers of is there is a lack of a real main character. Like, it's more of an ensemble of main characters, which sometimes can work, but until now, each book had a very, very clear main character. Like, there was no doubt. And here it's more spread out. Like, is it Duncan? Is it Odrade? Is it Shyanna? I mean, Shyanna barely does anything.
Lots of people barely do anything.
Yeah, and like, and not only that, but the other issue is they're all in the same place. The ensemble as a main character usually works when they are showing like different places and different subplots. But in this case, they're all on chapter and they're like literally talking to each other. So it's a little bit...
I mean, to say, what is it with these books and locking people in a place and have them train for the majority of the book? I was like, not again. It's like the same thing, but more people and more random.
Yeah, with much more action.
So that's what I meant by this dissonance, or how you'd call it. I guess I like it because the training is more interesting than the fight, and the things they go through during the training and the things they learn is kind of the point. And then when you just skip the fight, I kind of get it. Maybe I'm not old enough to appreciate it or something.
I don't know.
Because I wanted some action.
Yeah, it is true that it feels like Duncan went through all of this training and does all of these things, and then the book just ends.
Yeah, there were so many things. There was 99% build up and none of these things paid off. So I wanted something to happen, like, but it didn't really, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, that's why, like, I don't buy too much the story that people were like, you know, Frank Herbert wanted to finish the series with book six. Like, there is all this built up. Like, it clearly feels like it's going somewhere and the characters are being prepared for something. But then that something never comes to be. So it's like, okay, well, now what? So, yeah, I don't buy that.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. I don't want to be negative, but I wrote down a few things that I was disappointed about. For example, you kept hyping me up about how crazy it will get, and it was true for the fifth book, and then I was expecting something bonkers here. And...
To be fair, I never said that the sixth book was crazier than book five.
I know. But you sold it as, I'm gonna see some stuff like when I read this book. And I was like...
there is one scene in particular. Yeah, well, not one scene. Like, there is the horse, and then another scene that I think we need to discuss.
Okay, yeah, we'll really talk about it.
And then
course.
Finally, there are like a couple of Dune references that, including I'm not sure if it's the very first Dune reference we've had on this podcast, but maybe one of the very first ones, which is, like, if you remember when we were doing Three Body Problems, we were talking about Van Gogh, and I said, oh yeah, this is a Dune reference. You were like, what are you talking about?
Okay.
And finally, we have reached a point where that makes sense. And then the other one was when we were talking about Hyperion and talking about the Jews.
Oh my god, I didn't know that at the time. Oh my god. Okay, so another thing I was like really, really, really hoping was that the Tlalaxu would have something to do in this book.
Saitel,
that's something I really didn't like. Like, why is he there?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be Vaf or something?
I agree. I was kind of confused. First, because now Saitel is a master instead of being a Fae Stancer, which is...
I'll take it. That's fine.
Okay. I mean, I guess.
It's weird, but whatever.
But yeah, besides that, it is kind of confusing where it's like, yeah, like, what?
I was very, very... Ever since the second book, when we talked about it, how I was excited about the concept of them being basically immortal and perfecting these Kola tanks and all this, and Exalted tanks, and why didn't it come up? Like, I was sure there's gonna be a Tlalaxu master somewhere, and he's gonna purposefully be killed over and over again and coming back resurrected.
I wasn't really expecting that, and I'm glad it didn't go that way. I think that's kind of like a very...
Okay.
I don't know. It's such an Hollywood thing. Someone with that power in a movie definitely would have a scene like that. I don't know. I like to see this more like... That's a reference you will not understand. Like, it's like Rei Ayanami in Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Okay, some people know who are listening.
I think most people will probably understand it. I would hope. Like, of course, yeah, there are clones and this person is... basically immortal because can be like replaced by a clone every time, but it's not overplayed, so I like that.
Okay. I was very hyped for the concept of them storing the memories. Like, in the previous book, Duncan remembered all his deaths, and there was like the next evolution in the steps of making the exalted tanks better, and then they talked about the face dancers becoming a person and they can't control it anymore because they imitated the person too well and now they don't even know they're a face dancer. All these concepts I very much am in for, and they were not there anymore, so I was sad.
Well, I mean, it is there, like the two, like the old man and the old lady.
Yeah, but
they do nothing. The idea was that they would have been
been in the next book. Yeah,
probably the end game villain in the seventh book.
Yes, so that's what probably would be my favorite thing, but unfortunately we didn't get there.
I like the atmosphere of this book in a sense that it feels more like, you know, an old man wrote this book. Like, let me explain what I mean by that. So, you know the theory, I don't know how confirmed this is, I think it's just a theory, that Homer wrote the Iliad when he was young and the Odyssey when he was old. Do you know that?
No.
Okay, so many people think that that's the case. I mean, assuming that actually the same person wrote it and that Homer actually was like single person and everything else. But the idea is that Iliad was written when he was young and he was like eager for glory and battle. But then the Odyssey was written when he was old. He still had a thirst for adventure, but his main wish was just to go home and rest. Nice. And that's kind of like all he wanted. And all of the adventures he, like Odysseus was going through, were just obstacles for him to finally go home and, you know, earn his rest. Which is something much more common in older people than younger people, right? Like when you're young, you want to leave and you want to go to adventure. You're not thinking about going back home. So this felt the same in the sense that the first few books were much more about Frank Herbert. Of course, he wanted to tell a lot of stories and he had a lot to say, but it felt much more like Paul going on an adventure and then claiming revenge for the murder of his father and everything that happened. But this book, this sixth book, really felt like, I think particularly in the character of Odrad, it really felt like, I just want to do what I have to do, be done with it, and that's finished. Yeah, that's, I think, the biggest difference between this and the five before this.
Felt very different, the whole book, and I think my mistake was that I read it in one go, kind of quickly, and I should have just taken my time. I guess this book would be nice if you read it like a little bit once in a while. Just really took your time thinking about the things and then give it time to breathe. I meant to say, I wish we were still here in 20 years. And as 60, 50, 60 years old men, we could reread the whole series and do the podcast again.
See how we feel about the spice orgy and the Ankan climbing.
And somehow at that time, I think we would appreciate the sixth book much more than now. But I don't know.
Maybe. I'm just saying. Maybe we'll appreciate the fourth book even more.
I will always appreciate it.
Old men complaining about everything.
Of course. So I would still recommend it. We always say this. I think if you've read book five, we already told you should read book six. Mm-hmm. But if you're somehow like discouraged and deciding if you just want to listen to us rant about it and not read it, I just say, don't spoil yourself. Just give it time. Read it slowly. I think there is a lot to like. I still really enjoyed it. This is one of the most quotable books I've read in a while. There's so many like poignant, hard-hitting truths. Like so many quotes I like so much. I wrote so many notes again. I will not say all of them. Don't worry. But I really liked it, and it was very, it felt like Dune. It didn't feel like the quality went down or something. It just felt different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'd like to do is, I'd like to quickly go over some ideas, because last time we did at the end of the episode and I talked to somebody who listened, and I think nobody cares at that point. People are too exhausted after the discussion, so I'd like to do it first now. And then we'll talk about the plot, which I think we will not have as much to say about the plot anyway this time. So I'd like to talk about some of the interesting things that I really liked and ask you what you think. These are not really spoilers, but it is what happens in the book. It's just more concepts and ideas. And to start with something very short, I really liked the comment about sentiment and sentimentality. There was a scene with Duncan and he was thinking about mentat training, and he discussed the difference between sentiment and sentimentality. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
This is like the quiz for Pablo. Dune quiz.
Yeah.
I really like this comment. He says that, what's the difference between sentiment and sentimentality? So if you avoid killing somebody's pet on the highway, that's sentiment. If you swerve to avoid the path and that causes you to kill pedestrians, that is sentimentality. And he talks about this because he says it's dangerous to be sentimental, but it's important to have a sentiment. Like, if you have something that's dangerous or difficult and you think about it because it's awful, right? You shouldn't do that and stuff like that. So you should have the sentiment to not do that. But if you think only about that and be super sentimental about it and just try to think about all these horrible things for no reason, then that doesn't help anybody.
Well, like, if you're led by your feelings, I guess. Like, it's important to make decisions based on what you feel is right, but if you're led by your feelings without rationale, then...
Yes. So there was a lot of talk about being a mentat again and like putting more depth onto the mentat training and how they think. I like that a lot.
Which I think is interesting. Like, the mentat thing is kind of disappeared.
Yes, and it was back, so I was happy.
After book one, like, it is mentioned, sometimes it's used. I mean, clearly Teg is maybe the strongest example of mentat powers, if you want to call it that way, being used. But like the more introspective part of what it means to be a mentat was kind of forgotten since book one.
Yes.
So
I was super happy they have more to say about those. So I liked. There's also a point where they discussed if you go too far into the depths of mentat reasoning and like thinking, then you completely become a cucumber and the people that happen to them. I'm not sure it was the fifth or sixth book, but they talk about what happens if you don't have put limits onto your like exploration of the human mind. It was cool. And one more thing about mentats, I wrote, this might be one of my favorite things throughout the whole series. It was in the fourth, fifth and sixth book, and also in the afterword, supposedly this is Beverly's idea, Frank's wife. They talk about something called cultivated naivety, and when you're learning something, then you shouldn't blind yourself by assuming that you know it. There's a thing that Duncan says when he thinks about how mentats were trained, that it's dangerous to have an accumulation of the things I know, or the things we know, the like quote-unquote. So if you assume you know something, then you actively prevent yourself from ever questioning it or learning more about it, which I think is super true. And Frank was talking about how his wife has this playful like naivety that helped her just see things fresh and learn things again, because things change and you forget and there's always more to learn and improve. And if you just assume it's fine and it's done and your skill is perfect, then you will never become better and you only degrade.
No, but even like, so I don't know if you ever experienced this, but so you know when you learn something, let's say it's like in university or like even at work, you do something for a while and then you go back and look at your notes when you were learning that years before, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, I've gotten used in doing things the way I do them. And of course, the experience is valuable, but I have completely forgotten that all of these other things were important too. And that's why I'm doing certain things and not others. And I think that's always very refreshing in kind of like valuing your experience, but sometimes just like putting it to the side and being like, okay, so this is the thing that I have learned. And let me relearn it as if it was the first time.
That's very valuable. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, you can apply your experience on top of that. So, yeah, I think that that's very powerful.
I think that's wonderful, yeah, and very, very true. And many times you find that you've been just doing that the way you learned it because you didn't know any better and you can do it so much better. But the only difference, or the only reason you didn't do it better, was because you didn't even care you could do it better.
Yeah, that's so true.
That's amazing. And my favorite scene about this was... not favorite, but one of the things, just to go back to God Emperor of Dune for 5 seconds, is when Duncan is being killed by the Worm God many, many times, and then one of the Duncans, he gets so fed up with it, and he's like, I don't get it, Leto, I just like, you are fish speakers, I don't understand it, your religion, I don't understand it, and all this, I don't understand it, and you keep talking to me all this stuff, I don't understand it, and Leto's like, thank you, this is the first thing that made sense that you said since I revived you.
Yeah.
I love that scene because it's like, yes, you admit you don't know, so now you can understand something. Thank you. That's so funny. So yeah, that's one of my favorite things in this series. So there is a quote that's super short, and this is a good example of what I meant by getting slapped with like quotable wise things very quickly. in one of the prefaces of the chapter, which are very, very short. It's like one line. In the past, it was like, oh, I'm going to explain this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to like slowly ease you into it, and we're going to explain it, and then we're going to explore it. No. Now you're old. Bam! You've done it. One line. It's just...
Yeah, like they serve much
That's how I felt.
Less of a purpose for the story and much more of a purpose for just Frank Herbert to tell you stuff.
Yes, I imagine the same idea. If it was written like in the first, second book, it would be like a whole plot element, yeah, and a whole thing incorporating the story and shows and examples. No, he's just like, here it is.
Yeah,
you think about it. Yeah. Bye. So he says, seek freedom and become a captive of your desires. Seek discipline and find your liberty. So basically, people do whatever they want, and the more lenient and the more easygoing they are, the less they have control over it. And the more discipline you have, the more free you are to do what you choose, which I agree with.
Yeah.
Because then if you actually have the skill and control over yourself to do what you want to do, then clearly you can do what you want to do. If you are very easily swayed to be lazy and not do what you want to do, then you will never do it. So it's something that I see a lot.
I think more simply is, if you have no discipline, like when people talk about freedom, it's always like, oh yeah, you can do whatever you want. But when you're put in front of an infinite amount of choices, then you just end up doing nothing.
That's one part of it, yes.
Yeah, so, but on the other side, like if you have discipline in a sense that, you know, you have control about knowing what to do and what not to do, then you're putting a limit to the amount of choices you have. And that's kind of your real freedom, where you know you're free to choose among these choices that you know would be good ones.
So one more thing I really liked was they talk about why people behave certain ways. And they have this discussion about extraordinary behavior. And somebody says, if you think you know why you behave as you do, then it gives you all kinds of excuses for, and they say extraordinary behavior, but what they mean is doing stuff that's completely bad or wrong or nonsensical or useless, and the excuse is, oh, I believe in doing this, so that's why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have any other justification. It's like the easiest excuse you could have.
Yeah.
And I see this so often, like in real life.
I mean, that's like staying within Dune. That's kind of like what the Fremen were doing, right? Like they conquered the galaxy and committed billions of atrocities because,
exactly,
well, they believed in something. And that was a very easy excuse.
It's of course super serious, like in this example, but very menial, very everyday example. You just decide you believe something, like I'm a Virgo, like a sign of the zodiac, and then you're like, so I do this because I'm a Virgo, justified, and I can, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
it's like, oh, I'm this now, I'm a programmer, so this is how I do things. Mm. But it doesn't make any sense. Like,
yeah, I mean, you take on a role and then you act the role just because you feel like it's justifying your actions because it's part of, yeah, the role.
So this like justification cheat in this way, I think that's very dangerous and very common. Like so many people do this.
Yeah.
Like I'm a vegan, so vegans don't do that. And they never question if they wanted or didn't want to do that. They just like, oh, that's fine because I'm a vegan. Last one I like, especially with work and bureaucracy and companies, we always talked about one of your favorite points.
Yeah.
So I was curious if you like this one. They say that following rules and having policies and laws and stuff like that put in place inevitably carries with itself destructive momentum. By that they mean following the things without questioning them and always adding more rules onto them, mm-hmm, will inevitably lead to stuff that just doesn't make sense and makes it worse, because at some point there are so many rules piled up on top of each other and so many regulations and so many paperwork checks and stuff to follow, yeah, that at some point you even forget why they were there in the first place, and the other stuff built on top of them are following those rules that might not be true anymore, and then it just piles up and it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
So that's something I really identified with, especially with corporations and like work.
No, I completely agree. I think we saw most of that. Like a very, very easy example of that was back during COVID times when they established all of these protocols for reasons, regardless of how effective or how sensible they were, but then they just stayed in place and people built other protocols and regulations on top of that, and then it just stopped making any sense.
Yes.
I remember in 2023, it was last year. 2023, I went to the dentist and they gave me the questionnaire asking me, oh, have you had a fever, all that stuff. And then the last question was, have you been abroad in the last month or something? And I said, yeah, I've been abroad. Like, I had just gone back to Italy. And then they were like, well, sorry, then we can't have you here. Like, what?
Yeah,
because you traveled abroad and that's, you know, that's our regulation. It's like, well, you know, it's been 3 years and like now you can come and go to Japan freely. And like, why is this even there? Yeah, but I see this like in I don't think this is even Japan. I think this is just something that exists because people, again, make rules and then they forget why the rules exist and then never remove them.
Yeah, this is such a thing. Yeah.
Insert reference to the US and the right to bear arms. But yeah,
this is so, there's so many truths in this book. I felt the heaviest it felt to me compared to the previous books. The previous books felt less like this because they were more incorporated, the thoughts were more incorporated in the story, like you said, and it was more spread out and it was more eased in. And here I felt like constantly like so much to say. So that's why I like this book. I think this is my favorite point, that there are so many things to think about.
It's the wisest
book. Even though they had nothing to do with the plot. The wisest book, but nothing to do with the plot. Uh-huh.
I mean, doesn't talk about horses or Jews.
Okay, let's get to the horses. Let's switch to the plot. So thank you for indulging me in this part.
It's very, very interesting.
This is why I like this book. And I will be very sad going forward to find this kind of food for thought in other books. It's very rare. Somehow.
I think in Mistborn there is a lot of that.
Okay. Okay.
There's also, okay, actually, I do think that the two books that I always say you should read, and then one of them I think you will never read, but Journey to the End of the Dark and Infinite Jest. I think they do have...
The Infinite Jest, you think I
will
read?
You will never read it. Yeah. Like, it's such a hard book to read and it's pretty long. But they have a lot of this thing where it's like, wow, like, I never thought about that, but it's actually pretty true. And it's about all sorts of weird stuff.
That sounds very appealing to me. You sold it much more than the Mistborn series.
Okay. Well, you'll see. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so let's dive into the spoilers. Like I said, I don't have much to discuss this time, but let's go over the plot. And the plot starts directly this time after book 5.
No, there is a time skip. Like 15 years have passed or even more than that.
Oh, I thought that was like just like 1 year or something.
No, like Shiana was a child in the previous book. In this book, she's an adult.
Oh, yes, you're right. Okay, sorry.
She's very much of an adult. Right. This is the moment where we should put a clip of Christina talking about Alia being horny. Because yes. Shiana took over that role. Like she took Alia's mantle as the horny woman.
Well, these horny women.
How dare they?
Yeah, okay, so what's the update? So the Dune planet was destroyed, and the Bene Gesserit retreated to their chapter house planet, and suddenly there is Cytale in the ship.
So what happened is, during the time skip, so Arrakis was destroyed, they were able to bring back one sandworm to chapter house, so they broke the sandworm down into sand trouts, and they are starting to turn part of chapter house into a desert so that the sand trouts can grow into new worms and they can have spice production again.
As soon as I read that, I was like, wait a minute, you just destroyed it. At this moment, I was like, wait a minute, you just destroyed it. Why are you making it again?
Well, because they want it in a place where they can only be the only ones to control it, right?
I meant the writer. I thought he was done with it.
I know. But I think it makes sense. I mean, that's the whole reason of the title, right? Like, Chapter House Dune is because Chapter House is becoming Dune. But they're trying to speed up the process because they're using like technology to increase the speed at which the planet will, how do you say, desertify? I don't know if that's a word, but anyway.
Become deserts, yeah.
That's like Shiana's project.
So Shiana's grown up and she is now a reverend mother and she's in charge of turning chapter house into Dune.
Yeah, and Duncan and Morbella, they can't leave the no ship because
of intense sexual collisions. Yes.
Well, that's one reason. No, the main reason is they don't have Shiana's genes, so they could be seen using pre-science if they leave the no ship. So, because like chapter house is surrounded by no ships or whatever. I forgot exactly how they did it, but essentially Chapter House can't be found using pre-science. But if Duncan or Murbella leave, then they would be able to find them, and by finding them, they would find, like, the Hornet Mattress would be able to find Chapter House. That's why they can't leave the no ship, and they're kind of imprisoned there, and they have been closed in there for years.
This is a thing I realized way too late, because at first I thought they wouldn't let them out of the ship because they didn't trust them.
I think that's Sightail.
Yeah, of course, but I mean also Duncan and Murbella. But then halfway or some, like, later in the book, I was like, oh, wait a minute, that is the reason we just described. But they never say it. Did they say it?
Did they not? I don't remember if they say it, but...
This is what I mean, my problem with this book. They were like, I felt so dumb, or I don't know if I was half asleep or something, but they were like, yeah, obviously, this is a very clever reason and a very good explanation why they were locked in the ship, but... the whole first half of the book, I was like, why are they still in the ship? Get out of this ship! And then it dawned on me, like, way too late that they could be seen and detected. So, okay, but please say it more clearly so I understand what's happening. Like, why?
Fair enough.
Okay.
But yeah, so they have a lot of fun in the ship. Kind of like they have this relationship where they constantly need each other's body, but they kind of like each other. They feel like they should like each other, but they don't really.
It was kind of interesting, like, the whole relationship and the romance and, like, do you love each other, is love forbidden and all this.
I think it was very interesting because usually it's always the opposite, right? Like, it's always, like, you know, two lovers who can't express their love. This is kind of the opposite, where, like, they have this enslavement to each other's body, but they don't really care about each other, like, at an emotional level. I mean, they do care about each other at an emotional level, but it's kind of like, you know, we are in this situation. It's kind of like a married couple where they got married into an arranged marriage, and now they have to make this work even though they don't really know each other and they're not sure they really like each other. So I think it was really interesting, especially how they start to rationalize their own feelings and how in the end they kind of outgrow them and they finally are able to break down this supposedly unbreakable, like, physical and imprisonment.
Yeah, the resolution to that I really liked. Yeah, it was clever. I liked that. Even though constantly sexually colliding with themselves was a little bit over the top.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Also, it's funny because, like, the Reverend Mothers and, like, the other Bene Gesserit guards are
constantly watching.
Constantly, yeah, they're just there, like, oh, look at them going at it again.
It was like, again, like some, like, tidbits of comedy. They were in bed having a very serious discussion about love and romance, and Duncan was like, I can feel the sexual collision incoming, and Marvel was like, don't collide it yet, just let me finish my sentence. That was ridiculous.
Look.
Okay.
We've all been teenagers.
Okay.
We know how this works.
Okay, but yeah. They've been doing this for like 15 years now. So what the...
I mean, that's pretty jealous. Never get tired.
Okay. Okay. So the Bene Tleilaxu were exterminated by the Anat Madres, and somehow they caught Sightail and they put him on this ship as well.
Yeah.
Which I was hoping they would at least suggest how and where they got him and why him, but okay.
Yeah, like, I was hoping they would say something more about Sightail, especially because he's, like, a point of view character in a few chapters. So I was hoping he would say, well, first, how did he become a master from a face dancer, and a little bit more about the what happened with him and everything else. But instead, it's just like, I have this secret store of genes.
Yeah, that's a big plot point.
All these people and... blah, 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 blah. By the way, like, this is what makes me a little bit happy that maybe there isn't a seventh book.
Yes,
because...
we'll talk about it at the end of this episode. Yeah, but go ahead, yes.
Okay, you know, just because, like, the whole idea that, oh, yeah, like, Paul, Chani, and all these people are coming back, it's kind of like...
Yeah, I meant that at the end of the
we
episode,
this, like,
to mention,
really...
like, a little bit about book 7 and 8, but yes, you're absolutely right. And
no,
absolutely
no, I know. Yeah. That's what happens in book 7 and 8, right, so...
So he has like a capsule.
No, we don't need that.
With a repository of genes of all the characters of all Dune, Paul, Gurney, everybody. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Completely unneeded.
So I was very hyped. I was very conflicted and disgruntled about Sightail coming back for no reason. And then when the chapters with him started, I was like, here we go. Sightail's gonna do something. And maybe he's gonna be the reason why the Gunnet Madras destroy Chapter House or something. And nothing happened.
No, he's just there.
Yeah, so this was very disappointing.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like, I don't really buy that, like, he was not really planning a book 7, like, Sightail.
Clearly, it should come up.
His presence and everything he does and says, we're going to talk about this in the next book. That's kind of the whole thing, right? Yeah, it's as if you say, like, you know, book three, Leto becomes a, he wears like the warm Iron Man armor, and then it's like, yeah, that, yeah, this is how it ends. Like, no, that makes no sense.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely was planning more books. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then there is this plot with Lucilla.
Poor Lucilla. Like I mentioned in the last episode, she's the equivalent of Princess Irulan, where she's amazing, and in book five she just gets constantly humiliated.
Mm-hmm.
Like she wants to imprint Duncan, but then Duncan is like, I want to do it, but no. And then she's like, oh, now I have to pretend to be a prostitute, and yeah, I have to like sleep with Burzmali.
Yeah.
And then all of these things, and then in this book she's just like, oh yeah, I get captured and then die a horrible
Yep.
Her chapters are really sad, and but I do think that her part in prison is after she gets captured by the Horned Mothers is pretty interesting.
It was fun. Like, yeah,
her whole line of reasoning about dying of like a remorseless death or something like that. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, like I said, all this book was kind of interesting, but there wasn't any like high quality, super excited, amazing something. I don't know. It was pretty good. Yeah. So June, Arrakis is destroyed, and Lucilla doesn't go with them to Chapter House, but she's somehow captured and goes to Gamo.
Well, first she goes to see the Jews.
Yeah, so I thought the Jews were on Gamo. That's what I meant to say. Oh, no?
Ah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. So the space Jews, like, I was so space surprised. Jews. And also not come doesn't come up like why space Jews suddenly, like,
I don't know.
So there is a group of revivalists or some kind of religious group that get inspired by Judaism or what?
Well, what it says is the Jews kind of pretended to disappear through history so that they could escape all persecutions, but they secretly have kept their faith alive for tens of thousands of years. Okay, that's interesting and everything.
And then there's secret Israel somewhere and all these rabbis.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt this was so unneeded.
Yes, absolutely unnecessary.
Like, I felt this was so much like Frank Herbert wants to talk about Jews.
Okay, but why? Like, I don't get it at all. Why he...
Yeah, but it just is... Also because one of the things that I think is extremely interesting about Dune, I don't think we talked about this so far, but in general, for me, one thing that I'm always wary of is when there is sci-fi, and when there is sci-fi that is set in our universe and humans coming from planet Earth, there is so much, for whatever piece of media, wanted to reference something about the present or our kind of like recent and understandable history.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes it's small things, like, you know, there are characters or planets or whatever named after historical figures that make sense for us. Sometimes it's like Hyperion, where so much stuff is clearly referencing things that make sense for us living in the 20th and 21st century. But then, like in Dune, there's basically nothing. I think he does an excellent job at until this point, where, like, yeah, sometimes Leto mentions something that makes sense for us. Like, he mentions Bach, or like, there is Van Gogh. Okay, makes sense. And, you know, those are names that make sense for us. But for the most part, when they talk about history and when they talk about like culture and when they talk about these things, even when they talk about language and different languages,
yeah,
these are all things that make sense for the characters in this very distant future. And they're not supposed to make sense for us. They're not supposed to be relevant references for us, which I think is great. This thing was the only time,
yeah, it's
in
so random,
all of the six books where it's like, again, this makes sense for us, but for these people who have, Earth hasn't been inhabited for like 15,000 years, if not longer, why would it make sense to,
yeah, it doesn't make sense,
like, to have this? Very... Even if you don't want to talk about the other religions, right? Like the Orange Catholic Bible doesn't really have anything to do with, like, our Catholic religion,
exactly,
or like Zen Sunni religion doesn't really have anything to do with,
that's
like,
what I like very much,
Sunni religion, right?
It's almost like he went to a bar and there was like a guy and he was like, yeah, they're pushing you to write all these Dune books, right? So I bet you can't do what you like. And Frank Herbert was like, I can do whatever I want to do. And the guy says, okay, why don't you put Jews in there?
Sure. Space Jews.
It wasn't bad, it was just randomly out of place. Like, what?
It was a little bit jarring.
Yeah. So Lucilla is kind of rescued or just given sanctuary by this rabbi who is a Jew and all this, and then the Jews betray her and give her to the Honored Matres, so the Honored Matres don't destroy the Jews. And then we have this exchange where Lucilla is in the cage and she keeps having discussions with the Spider Queen, aka Dama, is the name, which is funny because in Czech language, Dama means lady.
Yeah. In kind of oldish Italian, too.
Okay.
So the best part is, one, yes, it can mean like Dama, like Madame, like Dame. Mm-hmm. But in Italian, it can also, Dama can also be checkers.
Same in Czech. Same in Czech.
So it's kind of funny, but yeah.
Okay. So it's a good name. And it ends up with Lucilla pushing Dama way too hard. So Lucilla basically trying to find information and try to find some hold, some control over her. And Dama doesn't have any of that. And then she kicks her face, kills her. Which I was surprised. I didn't expect that.
Yeah. No, I was kind of like, please don't die. Like, it's so bad.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked.
You're a pretty cool character. Why is this happening to you? Yeah, and also there was like the furry
Futar,
kind of raped her and eaten her.
Yeah. They have Futars who are like half animals, half people, something. And they speak with broken English. And yeah. And before Lucilla was killed, she touched foreheads with Reverend Mother of the Jews. And so her name is Rebecca. And she basically gives her all her memories to the, what is it called, Lampadas. Mm-hmm. So they can still transfer the memories. So if Rebecca stays safe and in secret, then she can still preserve Lucilla's memories.
Yeah, because what had happened was, so the reason why Lucilla was on this mission was that there was a planet where, was it a planet or a ship? I forgot. But anyway, it was attacked and destroyed by the Honored Matres. Yeah. And Lampadas was the only surviving Reverend Mother. And she gave her memories to Lucilla. So Lucilla knew what had happened.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, that information had to reach Odrad, or Odrade, however you want to call her, and Chapter House. So Lucilla's victory is in for them to receive this information. So she dies kind of a sort of a heroic death in a way, but I don't know. I wish she could have done more.
Me too, and that's why it meant something, the death. So often in stories, I don't care about any characters at all, so it showed me I cared about the character. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's not bad. I still like this book a lot.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, on Chapter House, there is Marbella, Sightail, and Duncan in the No Ship.
Yeah.
We still haven't talked about Teg, Teg being a Gola.
Yeah, he's a child.
So they need a new Bashar, a new super commander to super strategize and super fight. Yeah. So they create a Gola. They just shove under the carpet that they have created their own Exalted tanks and they don't want to talk about it.
They created what? Sorry?
The Exalted tanks.
They received one from the Treylax before they got destroyed.
There's like these all intrusive bad thoughts you have when this is mentioned. And you're like, so does it mean they connected the tank to a different lady? Did they receive the lady with the tank? What's... let's not talk about it.
I think they received a lady with a tank.
Let's not talk about it.
Yeah.
It's too disgusting to mention.
Okay. Yeah.
Tank is a small boy and he keeps getting all this training and they are planning to awaken him when he grows up and become the Bashar. And Odrade is having this secret plan how to fight the Honored Matres. Mm-hmm. And basically the whole book is Odrade politicking and checking and planning stuff on Chapter House.
Yeah.
Marbella, Duncan and Laxu just doing stuff in the snow ship, but not really doing anything. And then,
yeah, and so there's also like a strong opposition to Odrade, like Bellonda and
that part,
many others are kind of like, yeah, what are you doing? You're kind of doing nothing and here we're losing the war and do something.
So most of the book, like 80% now of the book is just this. And then there is like a climax at the end. But
yeah
it was first I was excited to learn more about Chapter House and like the Bene Gesserit and all this politics and what did they actually do. And I grew increasingly tired of it. And Odrade like walking
I
around
think,
Chapter
so
House.
So to me the most boring part, I think overall it was not boring. I think it was interesting overall. But the only kind of boring part was Shiana's project where she was kind of a loose cannon. And then they were like, oh yeah, she's starting to seduce her guards and like kind of doing whatever she wants. And Odrade has to go there and kind of like keep her in check. And it's like, yeah, okay. Like Shiana is just, okay, whatever. And we don't really know what does she hope to achieve with this.
It was, yeah, that part I didn't like either. And but what I did like was that not all the Revenant Mothers agree So they have these disputes, and there is Odrade and Belonda?
Yeah, Belonda.
Belonda. So Belonda kind of disagrees with her, and she keeps telling her what's dangerous, what's wrong, and they keep kind of fighting about it. And the same thing is kind of happening on the other side with Logno and Dama.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that kind of duality where both sides have like disagreeing parties. It's not just like uniform, everybody knows the same.
Yeah, I agree. And there's also like the part about Murbella that I think is, because Duncan's part is more like, yeah, there is the mental part, which is, I think, pretty interesting. And then, yeah, he's finding out about the Matrix. Like, he gets super interested in weapons. Like, there was kind of a bit strange. But and then there is the part where Murbella is being trained to become a Reverend Mother. And they want her to...
Everybody's a Reverend Mother now.
Yeah. And she has kind of like these conflicting feelings where she has to realize she actually wants to become one, because she at the beginning she's just like, yeah, I hate the Bene Gesserit, like that's how she was raised, and then starts being like, no, actually I do want to be one of them.
I feel like that part should have been great, and I didn't like it.
I think
somehow
it was,
couldn't care about Murbella.
Yeah, I think it was interesting.
It wasn't bad, but I wasn't very excited about Murbella's internal struggles and sex, and then her training and all this. Then there's like a whole plot point how she pushes herself too hard and she almost passes out, and then they have to like tell her she shouldn't practice so hard and all this.
Yeah.
Like, calm down, woman. Like, why are you?
Yeah.
And okay, so please finally tell us about the horses and Van Goghs.
So the horses just like, Odrade, for whatever reason, thinks that because Teg is a child, he can't move very fast. So she another Reverend Mother to, like, a Reverend Mother in training. I think she's not a Reverend Mother yet, just to carry Teg on her shoulders and be a horse for him.
And this also happens in the final battle. He's still like on somebody, sitting on somebody's shoulders. So funny. So the Van Gogh painting?
Yeah. So Odrade has a Van Gogh painting in a room. There's like a weird, I think it was a chapter, maybe it was more than one, I don't remember, but like where the Odrade's bedroom and like her office and everything gets described in very precise detail.
Yes.
Including the chair dogs, of course. It's kind of like, why are we getting like this super detailed description? And among that, there's also the part where she has an original Van Gogh.
Yeah.
And she's like, wow, this thing actually survived for tens of thousands of years. And I think it was in Taraza's office before hers. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's kind of like a memento of Taraza. I don't remember. But she kind of has like feelings about this painting and how, you know, it survived the test of time.
And then they even, at the end of the book, they take the painting with them or something, right? They steal the painting.
Yeah, I think so.
So important.
Yeah, like it is on the no ship. When they leave.
I'm very worried what the books 7 and 8 are going to do with this painting, because they are going to use it.
I don't think
they are. But okay, so Odrade just talks to all these people, they have all these meetings, and she has all these checks. She goes for a swim to relax. Then there is this struggle where she loves to see the chapter house planet is kind of perfect, everything's working well, and it's being destroyed because they are expanding the desert so the worms can be there.
Yeah, the part where she goes swimming, it was another... I'm confused. I think there's more to this than what I'm reading, but I can't really understand. Where, like, she's remembering her own planet and being a child and... like all of these things, and it's like
that part I didn't mind because it was just her.
Didn't mind, but I also felt like okay, she likes swimming. And she goes to this city, and there is a lighthouse, and
I thought they were trying to show the perspective of the planet.
Yeah, no, and how it's becoming a desert, and like she realizes like, oh, you know, I'm destroying this city. Like, this
so
city
that's why it made her sentimental. I think around the same time,
like this scene is being way too long.
Yes, that's true. Around the same time, I think the Mentat mentions about the sentiment versus sentimentality was mentioned. So I think it was kind of playing on that she was way too sentimental for no reason. And she didn't help anything. I think that was kind of showing that. Yeah, I agree.
That's a good point.
So I guess we can fast forward to the plot moving forward. Is there anything else before the imprinting you want to talk about?
So the imprinting was like the scene when we were talking about the previous book, you were mentioning something about Duncan being young.
And this is universe.
And And I was like, well, wait until you get to the sixth book. This is a part where I did feel a little bit uncomfortable, just in a sense, not because of the thing happening itself. It made me feel uncomfortable just in the fact that how all the characters react to this, where are a bit thrown off, but then it's kind of, okay. And then especially Shyanna being like, no, I really want to do this. Like,
I'm the
horny queen, and I just can't stop myself. It's like, that is, well, I mean, Tag is like 12, 13?
I was expecting at least a mention of somebody being uncomfortable with the imprinting, but every single person wants to constantly imprint everybody. Like, that has to be uncomfortable. Like, I get it that you're trained professional imprinter, whatever, you don't have emotions about this, but it...
I mean, the part is that Shyanna did have emotions. She really wanted to do this, and she was pretty excited about it.
It felt very surreal and not justified that everybody's so excited about this.
Yeah, and then also that they have to do this in front of an audience. That's like the other...
So what they're doing is that they need to awaken the Golas memories for Tech to become Tech, and they know that the attack of the Honored Matres is coming because Odrade is trying not to have prescient visions about an ex-murderer chopping her head off or something. That's all this. So they just need to awaken Tech. And I really liked the book 5 awakening scene, or the system, and how it was so much in depth and so interesting and so many interesting conversations. Skip to book 6, I messaged Paolo and I was like, so she touched his dick and that's it.
I was like, what? No, I agree. This was so unnecessary.
And more on point about the things I complained, how they mentioned them and imply them, and then you see the results of them without saying that they actually happened. Why didn't Frank do it for this scene? Why did he have to mention this exactly? And then he skips all the other important stuff. Like, why did you choose this not to be skipped and that to be skipped? I will never understand. That's one of my biggest gripes.
No, I agree. It is pretty confusing.
So there is everybody's watching this, a small boy having sex with a woman, and immediately Tag remembers his mother's training where she told him to never be imprinted, and he starts, first he's really into it and he starts moaning, but then he realizes that he's being imprinted and he awakens instantly, becomes Tag. Like, no struggle, no problem, nobody... It's done. It's awakened. Perfect memories of everything. Felt very, I don't know, far-fetched. Like,
I'm not sure why this is here. I don't know.
I was expecting something like this, and I was disappointed on many fronts, because first of all, you kind of hyped me up to have some nonsense happen, and I was waiting for more nonsense.
I mean, this is pretty nonsensical.
It is pretty nonsensical, but it's pretty short, and that's it. I wasn't uncomfortable. I was just like, okay, so if you're going for it, you might as well go for it more and do something interesting with it, not just like, oh, it happened and it's done. So Tech becomes Tech. And the final confrontation happens, super plan. They plan all these weapons. Duncan is the weapons master, and Tag is the super planning strategy.
Yeah, so one thing that we haven't talked about very much is the whole Honored Matres part, where we do get a little bit of exposition regarding them, because we talked about this in the previous book, how they didn't really get anything, so it was hard to get them as a villain, which was... Mm-hmm. Interesting in a way, because they had to feel alien. That was the whole purpose, but at the same time, it felt like we didn't really understand anything about their motivation. And here, first we learn a little bit about their history, how they are the descendants of the fish speakers merged with the Sama exiled Reverend Mother, which is interesting. And then we learn that they are kind of afraid of something.
Oh, I forgot to that completely.
And they're afraid that there is like this thing that can destroy everything, which is why like they need to complete this weapon, and why they have this pact with the Ixians.
And they want to take over Chapter House so they can find a new place to hide, I guess.
Yeah, I guess makes sense.
Yeah, so there's this big attack and they want to go to Junction, is it? Some kind of place, planet. I'm not even sure if it's a planet or it's just a place. Like, I wasn't sure what was happening. There's so much going down in the last few chapters. And I was like, well, slow down. It always happens at the end of these books. So it's like, just like, it's gonna bore you to death with training and then a whirlpool of events. I'm not even sure what happened. So before they head to this place, there is like a bunch of mentions of stuff. Like, for example, the Futars have handlers now, and the handlers, there's like a whole plot point with Dortua trying to find some alliance with some handlers of Futas. Never comes up again, never used.
Yeah.
And there is another plot, like, plot point. Oh, we have a technology to cyborg you, and they use cyborg as a verb. Like, we make a cyborg out of you because you too hurt or something. I don't even know.
I don't remember that.
So now we have this guy who's a cyborg. I was like, why bring this up now? Like, there's no time for anything. Shut up. Just don't put cyborgs in this now. Why didn't you do this like 100 pages ago? Like, what are you doing? Then they go to the place and they're introduced by some robots and there's like a bunch of androids and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, why are we doing this now? Like, this should be the final confrontation, climax, whatever. Why are you just describing all these androids? Like, what's happening? I was so like confused about everything. And then the good part happened that Odrade confronts Dama. And that part was great. I really liked it. That didn't disappoint. And at the same time, Odrade has a secret plan that she will kind of give herself up and she stores her memories into three places, into three people, just in case all of them died, somebody preserves her memories. So Shiana, Murbella, and somebody else.
Was it not Belonda?
Maybe Belonda, yes. Yes, Belonda. And she kind of goes on a one-way mission. They arrive to this junction place.
I think it's a planet, yeah.
And a poor guy who piloted the ship explodes himself. Just to show that this is a final stretch and they don't want to show where Chapter House is. And fuck you, Honored Matres, we are not giving you the ship. We just blew it up right now.
Yeah.
Which was kind of funny.
I mean,
like there could be other things. Like, the ships could have waited there, like, you know.
Yeah, but they would have been captured and then imprinted. And
okay, but they wouldn't have learned where Chapter House is. They could have deleted the memory of the ship or something. I don't know. It seems a little extreme to me to blow it up instantly.
It's fair. Blow up everything, always.
So Odrade comes to meet Dama, and there's also Logna, and I really liked the gambles that the Bene Gesserit had throughout these series, I mean for 5th and 6th book, where they always kind of know something, and they gamble in the conversation by pretending they know it, and that shows them the truth from the other side. So Odrade suspects that there is something else that the Honored Matres are escaping from, so she says it full on, and Dama immediately confirms it, so she learns that it's like this back and forth. This is what we like in Dune, right? These conversations where two people are trying to one-up each other. So here we go again, I was excited. And Odrade is noticing that Logna, or Logno is it? I forget.
Mm-hmm.
The other lady, she's kind of trying to take over Dama, and I'm not sure she go into detail, but that happens.
Yeah, no, I remember, and I think this is actually pretty interesting in the sense that Odrade immediately understands the dynamics. I think her own experience allows her to immediately understand the dynamics within the whole Bene Gesserit and Honored Matres. And
she's much more clever than they are.
Yeah. And how she can turn that into her favor. Which, yeah, that's really cool.
That was really great. Yeah, I really liked that part. And the part, I'm not really sure in which sequence or order it happens, but Logno, I think, kills Dama by like flipping her with a kick and then squishing her face on the floor or something.
Yeah, like they just kick people to death. That's what the Honored Matres do.
But this one was, she just like held her somehow and swung her against the floor with her foot or something. It was ridiculous.
I don't remember that. I just remember like lots of kicking.
Yes. At one point they go to a room and they have to take off shoes, and Odrade is watching the Honored Matres shoes and feet, and she's like, I should watch out for these murderers' feet.
Yeah.
That was ridiculous too.
Yeah.
That in the middle of all this battle, they just like neatly put their shoes away and go on some tatami. I don't even know.
It's only fair. Tarantino would be happy.
So then after this part, I don't even know, like, it's not very much explained what happens.
Well, there is
Tech
the battle.
Tech is battling everybody. Yeah, there's the battle, but the battle doesn't happen very much. There's just Tech giving orders.
Yeah.
People dying left and right.
Yeah.
Then cut to Odrade watching it. Then cut to everybody being already dead. Mm-hmm. And then a slight mention of they have a weapon we haven't seen yet, and everybody's feeling very bad about it.
Yeah, they are using biological weapons.
So I was immediately thinking, like, is this something that's spread on the ship? Is it everywhere? Are they timing who's dying when? Is this like a ultrasonic beam that activates some virus in your brain? What is happening? And they never talk about it. And who died? Like, the whole army of Tex died?
I don't know if it was all. I think like they were winning and then they...
They don't say anything. I reread this part 3 times and all it said was take notice that everything's quiet and all the honored matters that still survived are suspiciously calm. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of dead bodies without any signs of struggle or blood or anything. And that's it. And then you're dead in the end. And I was like, what? Tell me something else.
Yeah.
So from this point, we cut to Mirbella forcing herself to become... the connection between Bene Gesserit and the honored mattress.
And she does that by kicking the other honored mattress to death.
There's always somebody complaining because nobody's okay with her becoming the new superior honored mattress, whatever you call that. Every time she just kicks them to death. It asserts dominance.
And also she's done with Duncan. She realizes that now being a Bene Gesserit and being a honored mattress is more important for her than Duncan, and so she's done with it. And Duncan is like, yeah, weapons, computers. Yeah, I like my headcanon is that Duncan is like, I noticed Shiana's performance, I noticed her potential, now it's time, it's my time, it's honky boy time. This is my headcanon. This is just my headcanon, but...
Oh my god. I was about to say, this is the least Duncan was dumb in all of these books, and he finally has some sensibility. He finally knows some reason in his life, but no, the way you explained it is just good old Duncan again. Sounds much funnier this way. So, okay, let's assume that's what happens, and Duncan assumes that he needs to leave with a different woman, because that's the hotness now. And they decide to leave in the no ship, because they are not sure that... Honored Matres, when they come to Chapter House with Mirbella, they will keep Mirbella alive, and that alliance is very fragile, so they just want to make sure that somebody survives with the important stuff. So they take Saitel, Siona, Duncan.
Like on the no ship is Duncan, Siona, and Saitel, and Teg.
I thought there was somebody else. Wasn't that like Rebecca there or something? Rebecca comes back and everybody's happy that she has the memories, but then what happens next, I don't remember.
Don't think Rebecca was there. Let me see if I can find it very quickly. But
because I thought one more person was on the ship.
Ah, yeah. By the way, no, Logno, she kills Dama with poison, not with a kick.
But somebody like smashes somebody's face with a kick. I don't know.
I think it's Mirbella smashes Logno. It's just Shiona, Duncan, Saitel, Teg, and the Jews. Okay, yes.
The Jews.
And the Jews we forgot the other important part, which is one of the worms.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that part actually I liked when they tried to persuade Saitel to give them information and they show him the baby worm and all that. That was fun. But not very necessary.
Yeah, and then Duncan is like, I can see the Matrix. And he just pushes buttons.
Yeah, that part. I didn't understand if it was in his head or if it was somehow kind of interface with the no-ship or if it was just everything together.
Well, throughout the book, when he's going through the computers, the ship computers, he could see these... two people, like an old man and an old woman who looked like farmers, and they seem to notice him looking at them, and they also make other comments on, like, for example, Saitel and the Treilaxu masters, which kind of makes it sound like they are face dancers.
Yes, they mentioned the ones with many faces, and they kind of imply that those are previously at least face dancers, so they somehow came
and
from
face
dancers. And
then Duncan is like, this is where we need to go, pata 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 pata. And then they go there.
Yeah, and I was like, what? Yeah.
But they actually go to a new, completely new place in the universe when I don't know where they are.
And there's this mysterious conversation between these two so-to-be face dancers about them being upset that they didn't do something in their way, or they didn't introduce them to this planet or something, and they left without them.
Yeah, like they escaped the net. Yeah, like, so what many people see this dialogue as is... like Frank Herbert and his wife discussing how the characters have reached life of their own and they can't control them anymore, and so it's okay to let them go. And that's why people say, yeah, this was like the ending. I don't know, I can buy that to a certain extent.
Yeah, I don't buy
that he wanted to portray something like himself and his wife as the, you know, creators of the story and wanted to let go of the characters and the new universe.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't buy it very much, because if that was the case, why would they say something about being face dancers? Like, what's the gain in that.
Clearly this was a setup for the next book.
It's clearly just a setup for the next book. And also, what's the point of explaining like all the things about the Honored Mattress and their weapon and how they're escaping from something and all of that stuff? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the purpose of all of that? So I don't buy it. I don't think these two characters are there just for this reason. For Frank Herbert to say goodbye to the story and the characters, unless it's something he decided right at the end and then he didn't want to, or he couldn't be bothered to change the whole book. But to me, no, like these were just characters. they were just saying something that made sense in the story. They were not referencing anything else.
So I have to say, this is something I was afraid of, and I didn't dislike it, and I didn't think it's bad, but this is the weakest ending of all the six books to be.
It's a good point. I think so. I think the weakest was probably the fifth one, just because the fifth one is just a direct segue into the sixth one.
Yeah, you're right. In terms of enjoyment, I liked the fifth more than sixth ending, but yeah, I know what you're saying. It's true. So before we finish this episode, very, very quickly, I want to mention the book 6, 7, and 8. I never really cared, obviously, because I didn't read 6 yet, but now that I finally read it, I was just reading around a little bit. I never really checked who Brian Herbert was and who Kevin J. Anderson was, because both of them wrote it together, like the sequels, prequels. So I listened to some interviews with them, I looked at some talks, and I think better of them than I used to, because I felt like Brian Herbert felt to me like he didn't care. Like, of course he cares about his father, and of course it's a legacy, and of course he's got lots of respect and he loves the series and all this, but it felt to me that very blatantly he just wrote all these books for money and stuff like that.
that's what
people told me, because that's kind of the impression that it's a cash grab, like all these books are just the name and they don't really mean anything. So I was watching a talk with them, both Brian and Kevin, and Brian was saying that for 11 years he was contacted constantly by publishers and writers, and everybody was asking him for the rights, and he never wanted to do it, and it took 11 years of asking for him to decide that when he met Kevin J. Anderson that he would actually try to write something. And they talked about it super excitedly, how Kevin is so lively and he never gets tired about it, and Brian is kind of like more creative, and they had like a good thing going on. So it made me like think better of the sequels and prequels. And then I read the synopsis of book 7, and I was like, oh no. So everybody's revived. Everybody, like Paul, Leto, everybody's good. I was like, oh no. Oh no. So yeah, that's just wanted to say that. So it felt to me like they were the biggest fanboys, because Kevin J. Anderson was saying that when he was a child, growing up, he heard about it, and then in high school or something, he first read it, and it was like an exciting adventure, and he said he read it again when he was in university, and he loved it so much more because he saw the depth, and he's like the biggest fanboy. He says that it's his all-time favorite thing, and then if a fanboy's writing the book, then that's not good. But I don't think the books are bad, and I think they are bashed for being trash.
No, I agree. I haven't read them, so maybe, I don't know, maybe there is some merit to that. I just think people were so prepared for what you said, where it's just a cash grab and it's just whatever done to make some easy money and like gain some notoriety for himself, and I don't think necessarily that's what they wanted to do. And also I think because people always feel like with these things that they're kind of sacred and no one can touch them. You see this all the time with Star Wars, for example, right?
Yeah, I don't really care about that.
I don't feel that way. I think it's completely fine. Like, you wrote all these prequels, you want to expand the universe and everything, like, and everything else, because, well, first of all, you can always choose yourself what you think is canon and what you think is like where the story ended. Like, you don't have to read the other books, you don't have to accept anything else into the story that you have in your mind.
Absolutely agree. I think we're both pretty reasonable with this. Even if they say in book 7 that stuff that I love about book 2 are not true and it means something else, it's not going to change me liking book 2. Like, I don't understand why these people who rant about this all the time, like the Star Wars fans, always say this. I don't get it. So whatever they say about that in book 7 and 8, I'm curious. I would read it.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm ever going to read them, just because it's not because I necessarily think they're going to be bad. I think it could be interesting. I just don't want to spend too much time on it. Like, at that point, I just want to read more Brandon Sanderson. like what, which is what you should be doing.
Yeah, I haven't succumbed to the plague that is Brandon Sanderson yet, so I'm still interested in reading more Dune. So if somebody's listening to our podcast still and he's been through, or they have been through all 6, 7, 8 episodes, so if you're still listening, somebody, and want to read book 7 and 8 with me, send me a message at mindduckbooks@gmail.com.
Yeah,
I think this is the perfect content for a podcast because, you know, people want to know and they don't want to read it. So that's why the 4th book in the three-body trilogy is the most listened episode. Oh. People love that episode. I still get messages. So thank you everybody so much for listening. We will have one last episode about the Dune sectology. What is it called?
Sexology.
And we're gonna do the usual we do about series when they're complete on this show. And that's
I think it's Hesology, by the way.
Okay, so it's gonna be the best and the worst, and also the top 10 tips how to pick up women by Duncan Idaho. I can't believe we haven't mentioned.
Hey, Duncan, it's so easy. You just exist. So,
yeah, we'll definitely talk about those. I cannot believe we haven't mentioned that Duncan was training men to resist imprinting and then imprint themselves.
Ah, yeah. Okay, yeah, I forgot about that. That was such a weird
That's
part.
Gonna come up on our list of Duncan being Duncan.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening. If you've listened to all 6 books, please send me a message or comment somewhere. It always makes me happy. I still get messages about people finishing our trilogy about the three body problem. So that's always fun. Feels nice that people are getting something out of us talking about these things. So thank you for all the comments.
Or please send an email to convince Philip to read Infinite Jest and Mistborn.
You can do that too.